Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
My point stands that clinical facilities are very special. The people going into them are not going into them as a demonstration of support for an idea. They're going in there because they actually need treatment.
We're bringing out the most censorial law that the UK has seen to say that you can ban the expression of opinion. We've never had something like that before in the UK, and it's targeted against one particular opinion in one particular space. We've never seen that measure before.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome along. Today we're discussing a bill that could outlaw protest or even silent prayer outside abortion clinics in the UK. Anne Furedi and Lois McClatchy are my guests on the show that aims to get you thinking. And thanks to all those who came to our live show with Tim Keller. That was an online event just this past week. It was wonderful to have so many people joining us from all over the world. You will get to hear that on Unbelievable in the new year. But our next live show is the 10th of January with John Wyatt, bioethicist, on how to live faithfully in a technologically confusing world. If you want to be part of the online audience for that, unbelievable.live, it's ready to register now. We've also just launched our end of year appeal. Do please consider giving. It makes a huge difference to us going strong into 2023. The link is with today's show, and you'll be directed to the best way to give from wherever you are in the world. But if you want to help us continue to bring thinking faith to skeptics, seekers, and believers, then please do partner with us. We'd really appreciate you doing that. As I say, the link is with today's show to give to our end of year appeal. Right now, let's get into today's program. Today on the show, we're asking, should praying or protesting outside abortion clinics be banned? Anne Furedi and Lois McClatchy join me on the show today. There's a bill currently going through UK Parliament that could create so-called censorship or buffer zones outside abortion clinics to limit protest or even prayer in the vicinity of those facilities. Now, is such a measure necessary for the protection of women seeking abortion, or is it an infringement of civil and religious liberties? Anne Furedi is the former head of BPAS, the UK's leading abortion provider. She's speaking in her own capacity today, but she does believe that such zones around abortion clinics are necessary to ensure that women don't feel intimidated. Lois McClatchy is a communications officer for ADF UK. It's a faith-based legal advocacy organisation. She believes the proposed laws would set a dangerous precedent, even potentially criminalising private prayer. Anne and Lois, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Anne, why don't we start with you? Welcome back to the show. It's been quite a while since we had you on in studio last time. But perhaps you could begin by explaining what Clause 9 of this public order bill is actually proposing.
Well, it works pretty much in the way that you've described it, which is that it would criminalise any actions outside an abortion clinic within a certain distance, 150 metres, which would be understood to try and influence a woman's decision or in any other way interfere with her access to that clinic. My view on this is that it is a real travesty that things have really come to this, and that protests outside abortion clinics should be mentioned specifically in a public order bill, which is being brought forward to basically enable the police force to be very clear that they can act in circumstances where protest is seen to sort of interfere with the public good. So it will basically back up the police where they felt unable in the past to take action because they're kind of blurry issues.
Okay, that's really helpful. Perhaps Lois, do you want to add anything in terms of what these particular clause is suggesting, what the specific limitations are that it's proposing?
Sure, yeah. So Anne set out that it deals with anything that seeks to influence a woman. But the wording of the legislation is actually extremely far-reaching into what one can or cannot do outside of an abortion facility, on the, which, remember, is a public street, at least is it at the public space. So this actually includes not only influencing, but expressing opinion, simply occupying the space and doing nothing but occupying the space, standing there, informing, sharing information, perhaps about services available to women who'd like to find out more about different options, advising, persuading. These are all things that are perfectly legal activities and are very much protected in the realm of free speech. And are also, in that context, we're often hearing about protest, and we have these public images of that these protests are very violent and unacceptable outside of abortion facilities. But we know that actually a lot of the activity that goes on outside of abortion facilities is peaceful and is even helpful to the women who are there. So my key problem with this legislation is it brings in a blanket ban across the nation on all activity of all pro-lifers. No matter how they're saying something, it's not how they're saying something anymore. It's what they're saying. It's the content of their opinion because it's a pro-life message.
I wonder, Anne, if you could explain sort of whether you think that the way Lois has characterized the nature of the kind of protest or activity outside these clinics is what happens in your experience and why you do feel that this kind of public order act is necessary.
Well, I think it is interesting because I think with protests, we always have to look at what's happening in a particular context. And the context really has got to involve both the place and the intention that protests are carrying out. And I don't disagree with what Lois says about the protests in Britain, unlike in some other countries, being generally peaceful. But their intention is, and the clue is in the wording there, really, that they're pro-life, that the intention is to get between, not necessarily physically, but to either physically or metaphorically get between a woman and a kind of clinical treatment that she is going to the clinic intending to access, or indeed counselling, and I would stress that, counselling that she is intending to access. Now, this is where the problem comes in, because on the one hand, you have people who want to express their views and make their views known. On the other hand, you have people who are attending a clinic, not because they are pro-choice or because they have a strong view about the politics of abortion, but because they feel that they need a particular kind of treatment. And actually, I think all of us, when we're going to have any kind of medical treatment, feel strung out, stressed, maybe nervous, maybe unsure of what we're going to confront. And it seems to me that that is not the point to be challenging. And I'm sure that Lois feels that this can be helpful to some women. I have to say, in our experience, it's completely unhelpful. In our experience, women find it distressing. And to give you an example, you know, Lois may say that, well, there are some people there who are there to offer counselling. Why would you need to offer counselling on the sidewalk outside a clinic, when a woman can access counselling inside the clinic and in fact can't have an abortion procedure unless she has gone through a whole process that involves indeed counselling. In our experience, what happens is that women are told that they will not get access to counselling inside the clinic. When they get into the clinic, they're on a one-way conveyor belt to an abortion. And that's misleading. And it's very difficult for the women. And it led to one woman who, I think it was Ealing, apparently climbing out of the lavatory window in a clinic because she felt it was the only way that she could leave the clinic, because that's what she'd been told by people outside. If she just basically said, "I've decided I don't want to have this treatment anymore," then she would have simply been able to go out of the front door, because nobody wants to do an abortion on a woman who doesn't want it.
We do say that, but there is BBC polling from this year that indicates that 1 in 5 women who have abortions actually don't want to. And that's a really big problem for pro-choice, pro-life, doesn't matter. That's a big problem for everybody in this country. If we have 1 in 5 women feeling that they have to have an abortion. And let me bring in a perspective here that's not often mentioned or given a voice in this debate, but it's the perspective of women who have actually benefited from the services that have been offered to them outside of abortion facilities. There's a campaign group called Be Here For Me, who are mothers who have been speaking up against censorship zones because they themselves benefited from the offers of help available to them outside of the clinic. They are mothers who thought that they had no other choice. Alina Dalgariu is one spokesperson who's been very public with her story. She was abandoned by her boyfriend, fired, didn't have a job to go to, saw no hope, turned up at a clinic, received this leaflet of information that she could in fact have financial, practical and emotional support. It was available to her if she wanted it. And those charitable services were over and above anything that she'd seen before. And she was able to make use of that, continue her pregnancy as she wanted to do, and now is an empowered mother, and herself has gone out to offer those services to other women who were in her shoes that she once walked in. I think that we're often divided. This debate touches on a very emotive issue, abortion, and I very much appreciate that this is something that touches so many people's lives, and so often we can have those kind of glasses on when we look at this issue. But we have to step back and take our emotions out of it and say, if this is a service that is helping women, then banning that service is not a pro-choice move. Buffer zones aren't pro-choice, they're actually no choice. They're taking that choice away to receive that offer of help right at the point of need, perhaps where they haven't been able to hear about it before, and make an empowered decision. No one's forcing these women to make that choice, but it should be available to them.
Just before Anne comes back on that then, Lois, are you saying that the kind of choices they are presented with in the counselling in a clinic aren't necessarily giving them as many options as they should be presented with, and therefore this kind of engagement outside of the clinic is necessary to kind of give a true alternative, as it were? Is that your opinion, Lois?
So the women who have told their stories to the Be Here For Me campaign have said that the offers of help available to them were over and above anything that they'd experienced at the hands of NHS, etc. They were over and above anything they'd found elsewhere. So this is obviously a great service. Why not give women that extra choice, that extra information? Freedom of information is vital in a society.
It's interesting, and it's in a sense using the language that, you know, you might be familiar with. You know, it is a pro-choice thing to for people to have this opportunity, even at the doors of a clinic, to reconsider and to be shown what their options are. What's your thinking on that?
Well, of course, women should be given every opportunity to have choices, but it's I think there's a certain disingenuousness with this, because let's face it, if there is a problem with women knowing about these organisations, then publicise these organisations more. You know, advertise them more, provide the details to GPs, family planning clinics, organisations that can signpost women into them. There is something that is particularly invidious about standing outside the clinic to try and do that. I mean, the equivalent would be, if you imagine it, it would be people from a pro-choice organisation like BPAS, standing outside an obstetric unit or an early pregnancy unit, and basically saying, look, you might not have considered whether or not you want to have an abortion. We can provide you information about that. It would be absurd. We wouldn't consider doing it, because we think that even though we think that all women need to have information about their full choices, it would be absolutely an inappropriate space for people to be. What you do is we trust the counsellors inside the clinic to provide effective direction. And it's not as though these services are unregulated, because in fact, the Care Quality Commission inspect clinics to make sure that they have appropriate counselling on offer. So my point is that, you know, I think that there is an element of disingenuousness. I think there's an element of street theatre in terms of this, and it's very distressing to the women themselves. And, you know, it makes no sense at all to me to say that outside the clinic is the only way that you can that you can approach these women. It really
so,
isn't.
So it's it's not ultimately then, Lois, about women not having the information, but there's a time and a place. And it's an interesting example Anne shares. You know, should we grant the freedom to abortion providers to sort of, you know, leaflet people outside an obstetrics, you know, early pregnancy clinic? That would be absurd. It's about where and when this sort of information is made available, Lois.
Well, firstly, I think we do the women who have been helped a disservice by saying that it's street theatre. They have, that their lives have been changed. They've kept their children. They have grown up as mothers. So it isn't fair to say that it's street theatre to them, who have greatly benefited. But taking a step back, let's look at this from a free speech perspective. What this bill says, what the principle of buffer zone says, is not whether Anne or myself agree with the information that's being shared. It's about what the government agrees is okay information to be shared. It's saying the government can decide what a person hears on a public street. And if it's something that the government don't agree with, then they don't get to hear that information. Doesn't matter what's being shared, how it's being shared, if the information, note in this bill on a side note that it bans sharing information, not disinformation or misinformation like we've seen in other legislative attempts. This is about just simply sharing even accurate and useful information. And we're saying the government have the power to decide on a public street what gets shared. As, you know, pro-choice or pro-life, looking at this issue, it should concern all of us, because this precedent means that the government can then apply this logic to other issues that are controversial. What about gender critical feminism, for example, is often one that comes up when we're talking about censorial or censorship issues in our cultural climate. Could we see at some point a buffer zone being created around town halls that would stop people from sharing information that isn't approved of by the government about their issue? What about embassies? Can they apply for buffer zones to stop information being shared outside of them? The logic of the buffer zone has troubling implications if we take it out of that emotional and heated space of abortion, which is something that we associate with a very different debate as well. If we apply this logic of censorship, it's something that shouldn't fit in a democratic society. It's not necessary, it's not proportionate, it's not justified.
Anne?
Can I say, though, that I think that when you say take it out of this context, I think that's really the problem, because the reason why it's the case that this legislation has been brought, and I have to say it's legislation that I really wish wasn't necessary, and it would not have been necessary if people standing outside abortion clinics had agreed to move of their own volition. They refused, and that was why in the end legislation's been brought in different forms. But it, you know, if it wasn't a medical facility, I think the situation would be very, very different. And I think that it's come about not because the government particularly wants to drive pro-life views off the street, but because it recognises that there is already a dangerous precedent that is being set up, where you feel that you can interfere with people accessing medical treatment because you morally disapprove of it. Look at it like this. I'm going for a hip operation in, you know, about a month's time. And I'm having that in a private clinic because I can't wait the amount of time it needs for me to go into the NHS. There are people who think that private medicine is wrong and even immoral, and that it takes resources away from the National Health Service. Now, I honestly think that if, for example, somebody who felt like that, as probably a very large number of Labour Party members do, started protesting outside private medical clinics, and I was approached by people who were basically on my way into the clinic telling me that I really shouldn't be taking these resources away from the NHS, that there are other options, that maybe I'd be better off with physiotherapy, that maybe my surgeon is unsafe. I think if you had that routinely happening outside clinics, there would be legislation about that too. And I think quite rightly in a way, because my point stands that in context, clinical facilities are very special. The people going into them are not going into them as a demonstration of support for an idea. They're going in there because they actually need treatment. Sorry about my bird clock.
You've got a cuckoo clock going off in the background.
I didn't know what it was.
But no, point received though, Anne. And so it's this. So I get you that you're saying it's rather different to an embassy or a town hall or somewhere where ideas or policies are being debated. Yes. This is about people in a particular situation going to somewhere and then being confronted at that moment.
Absolutely.
Okay, Lois.
Baroness Claire Fox raised a really interesting point about this in the House of Lords last week. She raised the point that shouldn't you be allowed to protest outside of a hospital where mass medical negligence has occurred? You know, we had stories coming out from certain parts of England where babies had not, or motherhood had been neglected. I think it was hospitals in Kent had been showing negligence in care, in prenatal care or postnatal care. And shouldn't there be a right to demonstrate that? It is an interesting concept, but what I want to go back to is we're using the word protest and we're dealing with this term protest, and that's doing a lot of heavy lifting in this conversation. The government's been looking at the idea of buffer zones for quite a while. It's come to the surface now, but they were already looking into this issue back in 2018, and they carried out an independent review so that they could see there's all these competing narratives, what's going on outside of abortion clinics. They did this review and they found that whilst instances of harassment did exist, they were by far the rare cases, and that legislation already existed that meant that police could prosecute those who were carrying out harassment. They found that the vast majority of cases were silent prayer or offers of help, and no pro-lifers who were going out to silently pray or offer help considers themselves to be protesting. They're not making a political point. They're offering help to individual women. There's two main groups actually in Britain who are involved in this kind of work. One's called 40 Days for Life. They exclusively pray, normally silently. They have a statement of peace that all their volunteers have to sign that guarantees that they will behave with the utmost respect. They won't approach women, they will simply stand and pray. And sometimes they hold positive messages. They're very clear about that their messages have to be positive. It says, I'm here to help you if you want me to. Happy to talk, these kinds of things.
So this isn't the kind of protesting people sometimes have in their mind of grisly images on placards and so on, Lois. This is, as far as you're concerned, an appropriate type of way of engaging women as they approach these facilities.
They wouldn't even consider themselves to be protesting at all. Right. They're praying and offering, and this is an expression of freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly.
And the other group, just you said there were two?
Yes.
Apart from 40 Days for Love.
Sure. The Good Counsel Network, so their ministry is entirely based on offering, connecting women to services available, housing, practical support, financial support where it's needed. So that's their ministry. These are the main two groups that are operating inside clinics, both doing great work.
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, just to take these points a little bit in order, I mean, I think the Baroness Fox example is absolutely, it's a rather ludicrous comparison, because what we're talking about here is the protests outside of a hospital, not people who are going up to patients going into that hospital. And this is what we're really talking about here. We're talking about people approaching individuals who are accessing medical treatment. It's not protest outside the gate of a hospital addressing the administration. It's people addressing the patients and in one way or another trying to insert themselves into a decision-making process that patient is undergoing at that particular time. And I think the problem with this is, and it is a really grey area, it's one of the reasons why actually I don't like the idea of buffer zones. I really don't. I think that it should be, I think that as human beings, we should have the self-restraint and the humanity to understand that anything that distresses individuals on their way into clinical treatment is just wrong. And the reason why I think that is it a mass number of people being intimidating or is it just a few people praying doesn't really work through is because the single most distressing thing that I saw in the 17 years that I was running BPAS just involved two women who were actually quite elderly standing on either side of the door to a clinic that we had in Bedford Square in London. And they were simply handing the women who were coming into the clinic those little hand knitted baby booties that you have for new babies. And just basically saying, this is a gift to remind you of the baby you're killing. Now, to me, looping into the point that you made about the fact that you said, I think it was that one in five women didn't want to have an abortion. Actually, many women who have abortions, probably you could almost say almost no woman wants to have an abortion. But what happens is that the decision is often, you know, on that spectrum of grey. And the reasons why women end up having that procedure is because when all things are considered, they feel that it's the best thing for them to do. And they may say constantly, and these are the discussions that we have in the clinic, I would have this baby if. And sometimes it's the if you can do something about, if I could afford it, if I had somewhere safe to live, if my partner wasn't brutal to me. Maybe that's something that you can intervene in and you can signpost people to. But then there are other things that you can't. If I wasn't 15, if I hadn't got two children that I'm struggling to raise already. And it's that nuanced discussion that really needs to take place. And you don't do that on the street by handing someone a leaflet. You actually have to have good faith that people inside the clinic are doing the work that they should be doing. And I think that is lacking. I think that this is a construct that you believe that people who work in abortion clinics want to do the maximum number of abortions that they can for some perverse reason, and that they have an inclination that is anti-life to push women into that. And so a woman who is unsure will be propelled by people in the clinic to have an abortion, whereas I think many of us have a presumption in favour of life and are very happy when women realise that they can raise a child.
Well, we'll let Lois come back on that in just a moment's time. We're going to go to a quick break. We're talking about protesting, praying, or simply having a presence outside abortion clinics. Should that be banned? There is a bill currently going through UK Parliament, which is looking at buffer zones, censorship zones. Lois McClatchy and Furedi join me on the show today, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're talking about a serious subject today. Bill currently going through UK Parliament could create so-called censorship or buffer zones outside abortion clinics to limit protest or even prayer in the vicinity of abortion facilities. Now, one of my guests, Lois McClatchy, said really what's going on usually in the UK outside is not protest. It's simply people praying very often or offering advice or help to women who are potentially going to go in. Anne Faraday, former head of BPAS, who's speaking in her own capacity today, said, well, actually, there's a time and a place. And actually, frequently, these are decisions that are very difficult for women to make, and pressuring them in some way as they go into a facility is not the time and place to be doing that. Lois, what do you make of that? And I wonder also what you thought of this particular example. Anne sort of vividly remembers of women offering these knitted baby booties to women going in. You can see why that might be seen as from Anne's perspective as emotionally manipulative, essentially, for what is a really difficult choice that a woman is making at that point. What's your feeling on that first before we talk about, you know,
sure,
the rights and wrongs of that?
Yeah. If I kind of actually would like to ask Anne a further question, sure, to push on to that. And I was wondering, you're aware that the scope of the bill goes further than expected even, and it bans even occupying space. Would you think that somebody perhaps not approaching women, but silently praying in their head, just standing there, or maximum holding a sign, I'm here to talk if you want to, not approaching women, but standing there, holding the beliefs, but not saying anything, not doing anything. Do you accept with the bill, would you support that bill in criminalizing them with a sentence of up to 2 years?
I think that it's kind of a crazy thing, isn't it? Because I don't know how you could criminalize someone who is standing silently praying in their head. How am I going to know that you're praying rather than working out whether you're going to go to Starbucks or Costa? You know, there's simply, you know, these things, you want to push it to the absolute limits of absurdity about how far this can be continued. And I don't really think that it works. One of the things about prayer that I'm very aware of is how, you know, sometimes there is prayer that is the communion between yourself and God. There is prayer that can sometimes be weaponized. And I think that, for example, a bunch of people chanting prayers outside of a window of a counselling room definitely isn't something that should be allowed. Now, you know, you can say both of them are prayer, but I think that, you know, with this, as I say, I would rather there wasn't a need for a bill at all, but to carry this out to a kind of absurdum limit, to me, doesn't simply make any sense. I think it's playing with rhetoric. It's a little bit like saying that, well, there's a law that means that I can't carry a knife on the street. So does that mean I can't come out of a cook shop with a machete that I'm going to use to joint my lamb? No, it doesn't. I'm highly unlikely to be picked up under knife crime for doing that. I think you're very unlikely to have anyone be arrested or certainly convicted if they are on the street in the vicinity of abortion clinics, but they are doing nothing that interferes with women, because it's that interference, isn't it, that we're really concerned about here, not what's going on in your head between you and God.
It is absolutely absurd that that would be the case of the law. And I wish that it hadn't happened, but there's been several people over the last few months, weeks, that have been contacting our organisation because of this incidence of praying silently within their own minds within a buffer zone or praying quietly with one other person. We had Livia Tosici-Boltz was one of the cases we talked about in the media recently, and she was praying outside of a buffer zone quietly with a friend, and authorities approached her and asked her to move, even though she was even outside of the buffer zone, showing the slippery slope that this can cause once we ban prayer in or silent thought or quiet expression of opinion in one zone. It doesn't make sense to stop at 150 metres, why not 250 metres, and then we're off to the races with where you can pray in public and where you can't. We also had Rosa, who was arrested for silent prayer back during lockdown. She took a walk and she was stopped. She was asked what she was doing. She said, "I'm walking and praying." She said, "If you were praying, you should be in a church." And put her in a police car. She was praying near an abortion facility. They put her in a police car and charged her. We were able to help her overturn that charge. But these cases show that the authorities are not beneath arresting silent prayer. And this law enables that. We shouldn't have laws on our books that would allow things like this to happen. Even if people think that they're absurd or they wouldn't happen, they do. And we can't allow law that would allow that. Law has to be really specific and it has to be proportionate. This is what we have gained from the human rights. The European Court of Human Rights has given us very clear case law that, and as has the European Convention of Human Rights, that where we limit freedoms, fundamental freedoms, it has to be done in the least restrictive way. We have fundamental freedoms and human rights, and we all agree that these are things that we hold deeply, and it's things that the government can only interfere with when it's absolutely necessary to do so. What buffer zones do is they impose a blanket ban on all activity, all free speech on a public street near an abortion facility. It's not targeted. It's not justified depending on circumstances. It doesn't treat somebody who is being aggressive and harassing differently to someone who is simply praying in the quietness of their own mind or there to do good, there to do things that are helpful, there to simply have a conversation or even not to approach women but hold a sign. We can't have these kinds of laws that bring in unjustified blanket measures. It's not right in a democratic society. And today it's something that targets pro-life views, but it sets a precedent for views that are maybe not the most popular, that they can also be kind of booted out of the public space in the future as well. And that's not something we want to see in the UK.
Well, frankly, if it's something that sets a precedent for people obstructing women going into, or indeed men going into, other medical facilities, frankly, I wouldn't have a problem with this. And I think that the problem is that it's something that you have brought upon yourselves. You know, as you say, the reason why there needs to be a law is to prevent things that can't be resolved outside of the law. And that's what has been the circumstances in these clinic interventions. Let's not call them protests. Let's call it any intervention that takes place directly around a clinic. And the problem is that, you know, people can say as much as they like about the fact that, oh, well, I think it was very quiet. I think it was very civil. But when you have a situation where abortion clinics are experiencing women coming in who are too distressed, who have to be chilled out, you know, before they can carry on with the treatment that they're coming into the clinic for, then it seems to me that it's time to basically say time out on these protests. And I seriously think that this is something that is not an offensive in this instance by the state, it's been an offensive by yourselves to basically intervene in what should be a very private decision. And the fact that it's come down to this, I think it's something that has been deliberately posed as a freedom issue, whereas in fact we don't have the freedom to insert ourselves into people's private decision making, and nor should we. And in terms of, you know, I'm saying this not simply because I happen to disagree with the views of the people who are outside on the street. I think about it you know, the same way you'll be aware that in Brighton, we had for a while, some years ago, a terrible tit for tat situation where people who opposed abortion were turning up at the clinic in Wiston's Road and protesting. And because those protests were being advertised in a local church, people who were pro-choice decided that they would give them a taste of their own medicine. I disagree with that as well. It's just as appalling for people to be protesting and trying to disrupt people's prayer. You know, there are certain things that we should not be doing in a civilized society. And it's because these protests or interventions or street counseling have been upsetting women coming into a clinic that this law has been passed. Would that it were not the case. It's appalling.
And hearing everything you've said there, I do just want to like confirm though where you stand on this issue. Are you advocating that actually any kind of presence should not be allowed outside abortion clinics, whether it be someone literally standing there praying in their head, just the fact of having people who the person going in may associate with someone doing some kind of having an opinion on what they're about to go in and the counselling they're going to receive, that itself is enough to say that shouldn't be allowed.
What I'm saying is I actually think that it is morally wrong and abhorrent for people to be using the entrance of an abortion clinic to express publicly their anti-abortion views. I think it's a cruel thing to do, whatever form that particularly takes.
Okay, whether it be an obvious protest or whether it be something very, very sort of quiet or non-approaching. Yeah,
I don't necessarily want a law that says you should not hand a woman baby garments, but it seems to me that when it's used as part of a way of trying to dissuade her in any way from going ahead or intimidate her, that I think is not a morally right thing to do. How the law works in a way that it can defend women, I think is very, very difficult, because if you frankly are of a mind where you honestly feel that with righteousness you should intervene and somehow talk to that woman, then, you know, Lois is right. Why limit it at 150 yards? Why not have your protest of people dangling baby booties or, you know, praying 150 meters different? Actually, I still think it would be wrong. So I think that the law is always going to be a kind of a compromise. And I think that's where it stands at the moment. It's basically saying, do what you want, just don't do it within this distance in front of a clinic. And I think if someone is wanting to protest an idea, then it doesn't really matter whether they're right in the clinic entrance or whether they're 150 yards back from it. If what they're trying to do is to somehow insert themselves into an individual woman's decision making, then clearly they need to be in front of the clinic. And that's really what the discussion is about here.
Yeah. Lois?
Yeah, so language really matters. So I've got a couple of things, but I just want to come back at the start, and I don't know if this was an accident, but you said that when you started speaking about obstructing women from abortion, and just to be clear, there's been no evidence of polyphers stopping a woman from going in. So this is not about obstructing entrance to a clinic, and that's important. But the other point of which language is very important is this word protest, which is doing a lot of heavy lifting. We've managed to sweep a lot of activity that we wouldn't normally consider to be called protest into what we're now discussing, which sets a bad precedent. But also, assumes that this is always negative and not wanted by the woman. And that's actually, I find that quite patronizing as a woman, for the government to say, we know the conversations a woman wants and doesn't want to have. We know the decision that she has or hasn't made yet, and we know that she doesn't want input into that, and therefore you're not allowed to give input at that point of the street. We know from testimonials, from the work of the Good Counsel Network, that there's a lot of women who don't approach with a decision in mind, are interested in finding out about other options and are interested in conversation. And it's absolutely their right to have that conversation, to find out about options of support available. It's not the government's right to take those options away. So I think we need to consider this from a woman's perspective and not always consider this to be a negative thing, because the vast majority of times this is positive action to offer help.
Well, just coming back on you on that, Lois, I mean, obviously you're presenting the cases where there's been a positive outcome for women who have had, you know, some responded to the people who are there at the clinic. I mean, would there not be equally be an equal number, if not more, who have a certain amount of distress? I think that's what Anne's concern is, that whatever potential positive benefits are, there's going to be a lot of people who are distressed by seeing women, other people there, and that being what they're presented with before they make, you know, making important decisions or going for a procedure and so on. So are there statistics that you can draw on to show sort of how much distress or anxiety or whatever this kind of activity may cause women as they go in?
I think that's something on the other side to bring to Parliament. If the other side are asking Parliament to take out this very censorial measure, we know from the last time that a study was made in this 2018 by the government, an independent review, it was found that harassment, and I think we should be legislating on harassment, by the way, that's the concrete legal word, harassment is rare outside of abortion facilities in England and Wales, and they found independently that the vast majority of cases is silent prayer or offering leaflets of help. So it's on the people who want buffer zones to provide the statistics, to provide the case that the majority of cases are harassment. At the moment, we simply don't have evidence to support that. And we're bringing out the most censorial law that the UK has seen to say that you can ban the expression of opinion. We've never had something like that before in the UK. And it's targeted against one particular opinion in one particular space. We've never seen that measure before. If they want to bring in such a censorial law, it has to be evidence-based, and it should be proportionate. It should be targeted at the problem spots, if there are there, and a case is made for them. It shouldn't be a sweeping ban. It shouldn't be without a substantial evidence. And I think that before anything is brought in, actually, I think the government should do another independent review. If the case has changed since 2018, okay, let's consider if we need further measures to ban harassment. I stand fully against harassment as a woman, as any British citizen. Of course I stand against harassment. If we need further police measures to ban harassment, we can look into that. But that's not what the case says so far. And these measures go so much further, targeting help, prayer and simple thought, bringing in what could be your first thought crime.
So far too much, as far as Lois is concerned, being swept up in under this banner of protest, because then you're essentially censoring quite legitimate activities, potentially, Anne.
Well, I think the point is that it's some of these other activities that I'm saying are actually the most troublesome, because I would completely agree that it's not the case that, as has been the case in the United States, there are these massive demonstrations that are going out outside of clinics. But what I'm saying is that there is something here that is just like it's almost as though the discussion about there's almost as though it's a proxy discussion for what Lois thinks goes on inside a clinic. Because you see, when you say that women need this intervention outside the clinic, or there are women who welcome it, then presumably you're talking about women who actually you have turned away and haven't gone into the clinic. So therefore they don't know what support they would have got had they gone into the clinic. And the evidence that we can provide as abortion providers is the number of women who come into the service and then leave the service without deciding to proceed to an abortion, which can be around 17-20%, between 15-20% of women who would come into BPAS when I was there anyway, who then decided that they didn't want to proceed with an abortion. That the point that I'm making constantly is that the work about providing women with options is going on. You simply don't need to be outside the clinic to do it. If you want to promote your organization, then promote it in other places so that this isn't necessarily a doorstep thing. And what you're doing is the equivalent to an abortion provider going to a maternity unit, an early maternity unit, an early pregnancy unit, and saying, oh, by the way, have you thought about all of the problems that might be caused if you have a baby? Have you been properly advised about what your opportunity might be to have an abortion? You would regard that as being an absurd and an obscene intervention, as would I. You would not expect a woman going to an infertility clinic to be met with protesters or counsellors providing alternative counselling about infertility options. It's not a marketplace for different services. And I just think that it's utterly inappropriate. And I think that myself, that this is being quite cynically used as an attempt to almost provide a kind of ideological argument that people who are pro-life are also pro-freedom, whereas actually I think that the two things completely divide when it comes to organisations such as the Christian counselling organisations that exist. They're not pro-women's freedom to make choices. They're there specifically to dissuade women from terminating a pregnancy. And they're quite open about the fact that they're doing that. And I don't know why an organisation that actually has in its title that you're an alliance for democracy and freedom feels the need to...
Alliance Defending Freedom.
Oh, sorry, Alliance Defending Freedom. I don't know how you can even what? I don't even know how you can pose that when what you're basically saying is that you're supporting those organisations that wish to prevent women from exercising their freedom of choice.
Well, of course we're pro-life and for freedom. Essentially the argument you're making is that only the abortion clinic is the one allowed to give out information in that public space where people are considering abortion. The government can't legislate that only an abortion provider can provide information about services available. This is a very pro-freedom argument to say that a charity, an organisation, an individual is allowed to offer help, allowed to pray where they want to pray. Your argument about Alliance Defending Freedom goes deeper, but we believe that our freedom and human rights belong to every human being, no matter how old, how young, how much they can contribute to society, etc. That freedom and human rights starts from the very start of life, and that's why we defend the unborn, but also we spend a lot of our time defending freedom of speech, of many, many different fundamental freedoms in the UK. And this is a freedom of speech argument. This is a freedom in the public square argument to say that, of course, other organisations have an opportunity to provide their information, their services to women who are making an important decision. Now, the government say that we can't, that they're trying to ban influence of a woman. They'll never ban influence on a woman. Women, from the moment they get pregnant, are under a great number of influences on whether they have an abortion or whether they keep their child. Maybe that influence comes from a partner who may not be supportive, maybe leaving them based on this decision. Maybe it comes from family, friends. I have friends who have had abortions that through coercion from their social peers as well. Of course, there's influence everywhere on women who are considering this choice. all that buffer zones do is take away one of those choices, one of those options, and don't offer those services, don't allow women to hear about that information and those services right at the place where they're most likely to be most considering their options. So this is a very freedom of speech argument, and it's freedom for both those who are offering those services, those who want to simply pray in a public space, as that's of course their right under human rights law for freedom of religion, freedom of speech and more, and the freedom of women to be able to hear information for themselves and to make their own minds up if they want to respond to those offers of help or not. It's very much their freedom of decision too.
But you see this influence as equivalent to harassment by the sounds of it, Anne. That's what I get the sense. Lois says there's what we have already covers harassment, but you would say no, what you're doing at influencing people at that pivotal moment as they're going into an abortion clinic or is a form of harassment itself?
I think it is a form of harassment. I think it is a form of obstruction. I think that if you speak to the people who are actually doing it, they're very, very open about the fact that that is what they are there to do. And I just ask Lois, does she think that I have the freedom to promote abortion in the entrance of an early pregnancy unit? Do you think I have the freedom to be protesting in an infertility clinic that women should not have children because they're killing the children that already exist on the planet by exhausting its resources? I think, you know, we accept that there is a time and there is a place for activities to take place. And it is because, I think, of a massive overreach on the part of people who oppose abortion and have no trust in the providers of abortion that has led us to a situation where actions that would be seen as unimaginable at another time in our history are seen to be acceptable to you now. I think it shocks me that anyone thinks that it is moral and appropriate and the right thing to do to distress people on the cusp of clinical care. That's just inhumane and cruel.
We're going to go to a quick break and we'll conclude today's discussion debate between Anne Faraday and Lois McClatchy. We're talking about buffer zones outside abortion clinics and providers. There's a currently bill in progress in UK Parliament, and that's what we're talking about today on Unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We'll be concluding the discussion between Lois McClatchy and Anne Faraday on abortion clinic buffer zones in just a moment's time. Just want to give you a little bit of a heads up, though, on some of the great things available at the moment from Premier Unbelievable. Our new John Lennox Science, Faith and the Evidence for God course has been going great guns. Lots of people enrolling on that since we launched it 2 weeks ago. We're still extending that 30% off discount offer to listeners until the end of the year. Okay, so still a chance to get in there and get 30% off. Might make a great gift for Christmas for someone as well. That's at premierunbelievable.com/Lennox if you want to get hold of our new online course with John. Coming up later on here on Premier Christian Radio at 8 p.m, Megan Cornwell is in conversation with Julie Royce. This will be really interesting. Julie is an investigative journalist who's been on a mission for the last few years to expose bad practices and abuse in church ministries and celebrity Christian culture. So listen out for that on The Profile at 8 p.m. tonight or on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. She'll also be featured in the December edition of Premier Christianity magazine if you want to read that interview with Julie Royce. As I mentioned earlier, we've just launched our end of year giving appeal. If you'd like to support Premier Unbelievable and our mission to bring thinking faith to believers, skeptics and seekers, then you can do that from the link with today's show. I often hear from people for whom this show and other content from Premier Unbelievable is helping them to make sense of faith. In fact, we're going to hear from one of them next week on our Christmas special. Nico Tarquinio is a lawyer who was a dedicated atheist but had an adult conversion to Christianity, partially because of Unbelievable. You'll hear his story next week on the show for our Christmas special. And he's also joining me along with another very recent convert, Martin Shaw. Martin is a mythologist and storyteller who has an extraordinary story of conversion, partly through a visionary encounter during a woodland vigil. So you will hear that on the show same time next week. But again, if you'd like to help us reach more people like Nico with Thinking Faith and to tell the stories of people like Martin, of course, continue all of our good faith dialogues between different perspectives into 2023, do consider giving to our end of year appeal. The link again is with today's show. We've got some of your feedback coming up later on in the show. Right now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion. So we're concluding our discussion today on abortion clinics, specifically these so-called buffer or censor zones that are being proposed in a new bill. Lois McClatchy of ADF UK has been talking about why she believes this sets a dangerous precedent. It's a danger for freedom of speech, freedom of religion. Anne Furedi on the side of women who she says are often distressed by these kinds of interventions, and says that actually there is a place. She doesn't want to have to legislate around this, but sometimes you need to if inappropriate activity ultimately is happening. There are links from today's show, by the way, to both my guests, or you can follow them on Twitter at Anne Furedi and at Lois McClatch if you want to continue the discussion there. Coming back to you, Lois, then, I think, you know, we've heard this in a number of different ways across the course of the show today, that ultimately Anne does see that yes, while she doesn't want to have to create impingements on people's freedoms, there are certain types of freedom that we naturally don't give people necessarily. Would you be happy with protesters outside an early pregnancy unit offering abortion services? Would you be happy with someone, saying you shouldn't be seeking fertility treatment because we've got too many humans on the planet already? It's not that those people can't express those opinions, but should they be expressing them at that particular moment in that particular place?
Well, Anne said inhumane and cruel, and I wish we could explain that sentence to Alina and to the hundreds of women who have received excellent health, excellent charitable measures, housing, financial support, baby supplies. They have flourished and are so excited to be mothers because of the help that they received, and they're so excited about that help that they're offering it to other people. How that can be inhumane and cruel is simply beyond me. But what we have to remember is this is not about, we use the example of infertility clinics or churches. This is not inside those. But of course, the public streets are free and open for conversations and discussions. And we're using the word protest to do a lot of heavy lifting. But this bill bans expression of opinion, advice, persuading, informing, not misinforming, but informing of simple information. This is such far-reaching content that bans simple conversations from taking place. Of course, those conversations can take place in a free and democratic society. Women can choose to engage or not to engage. It's their decision, but they shouldn't have that right to make those choices, to hear about that information stripped from them. And we shouldn't be a society that polices conversations, that polices thoughts, opinions, and the sharing of ideas on the streets. Inside clinics is a different situation, but the streets are a public space where we're free to have the conversations that we want to have, and this bill goes far too far in limiting it. It should take a much more targeted approach. If and where there is proven to be harassment, we can have measures to prosecute that, because nobody should be harassing, but we should certainly not be installing blanket bills across all expressions of opinion. It's thoroughly un-British and thoroughly unfair to the majority of citizens.
Anne?
Well, I think that if you think that anyone is going to be arrested anyone who's going to arrest a mother advising her daughter, a friend saying to another friend, I'll help you out if you want to have the child, you know that, don't you? A sister saying, look, don't worry about the child care, I will help you with that. Of course they're not going to be arrested. What we're talking about here are people who are using the front of the clinic as some kind of a political intervention. And I think that that is utterly wrong, utterly inappropriate, and utterly indefensible when it leads to a huge amount of distress on the part of women who are going into that clinic when they get there. Because the implication that you've got is that they are doing something wrong and immoral when it's something that, as far as they're concerned, is legal and is something that they've made a considered decision about. So really, I think that the point is that, yes, the space outside an abortion clinic is a public space. And yes, we should have absolute freedom of speech. But I don't think freedom of speech means the right to say anything to anyone at any time in any place. We expect a certain level of civility. And I think, the actions that you've been describing don't have a place outside an abortion clinic. And I think that that's what's brought this action down. I don't even know why you would want to be there. Why would you want to be there? If you want to promote the organizations that can provide these excellent services, then for heaven's sake, do it so that women can access them when they are making the consideration of abortion right the way from the start. Don't believe in it until the last minute when they're going into the clinic. That doesn't make sense, does it? As a strategy, if you really want to be helping women.
Well, Anne's slightly rewritten her own bill there, because the advising clause is in there. We're saying, of course, they won't ban advice and for people who are nice, it's only the horrible pro-lifers. That's simply just not what the bill says. It's very expansive. It bans informing, advising, persuading, and all of these circumstances. Whether it's a conversation, one-on-one, a friendly conversation. And that is the majority of activity that is going on with pro-lifers. It's kind.
It's like when I say there is a law that prevents you from carrying a knife on the street. Right. It does not prevent you from carrying your cutlery home from the kitchen shop. And I think that this is the problem that we get into when the state has actually been forced to try to develop laws that will enable people, enable women to access a clinic. Is that you have, I can't defend the wording of Clause 9. It's absurd, because legislators have tried to come up with ways of preventing you and your colleagues from doing the things that are causing grievous distress to women accessing a lawful medical procedure. And that's where we are. And that's why I say protesters, pavement counsellors, whatever you want to call it, have brought this situation about. And as a free speech advocate, I utterly resent it, because I think that people should have the right to speak, as we are doing now when we're debating a particular issue. But you're not doing that when you're talking to someone who is entering into a medical facility, because they're not representing an idea, they're getting help for themselves.
Quick response to Lois, and then we'll have to wrap this one up.
I agree that it's not debate that's going on outside those clinics. It's offers of help or even silent prayer, which is an individual means, or a sign to say that they're available to talk, which is actually the much more common approach these days, because pro-lifers want to be the best that they can be to offer those services. And they found that holding a sign up tends to be a great way to say, I'm here to talk to you if you want to talk to me. And those measures, which are in no way harassment, prayer can never be considered harassment. Holding up a sign and not even saying anything can never be considered harassment on the other side of the road. These measures are not what's being described. They're not angry protesters. They're not illegal activities. And these are being swept up. We've had various people contact us about being in trouble with the police for simply praying in their minds or doing these very peaceful activities. And where PSPOs have come in to play already by local councils like Bournemouth, they've specifically banned silent prayer. So this isn't just about getting the worst activities out there. We could join forces and say that we agree that nobody should be harassing outside of clinics, and we could find measures. If more are needed, then let's find those measures that really tackle that problem of aggressive harassment, because that's illegal. We don't want that either as a pro-life movement. But let those who are just exercising their right to pray, to stand there with a sign to offer help, do what they want to do, because that's a great thing for our society.
Thank you both for spirited discussion on this issue. Just out of interest, when are we likely to see this bill progress? And I don't know if you can give us a timetable for how long this is likely to take before a decision is reached on these particular measures within the bill.
I think Lois would probably be better placed.
Okay.
Sure.
Lois, what's the timetable here?
I suspect it will be in the House of Commons in the new year.
Okay. Well, if you want more information, I'm sure it's available from ADF. There's a link with them. And we'll also link to BPAS from today's show as well. And, of course, to both my guests' Twitter, where this discussion I know has been going on as well. But for now, I do appreciate the way you've both been able to come on and have this exchange of views, Lois and Anne. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Always love to hear your thoughts and feedback on these difficult issues. You're welcome to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all of the emails I receive. I can't always respond to all of them or read them all out on this show, but we actually get through a lot of them that you send in. So do feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can, of course, follow the show on social media. At Unbelievable FE is our new Twitter account. Facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable to follow us on Facebook. You can, of course, comment there as well and tell us what you thought of the show. We've got a YouTube account as well, of course. A lot of people watch on video and leave their thoughts on the various shows there as well. If you enjoy Unbelievable, you'll probably enjoy some of the other podcasts we produce from Premier Unbelievable, our umbrella apologetics and theology ministry. Ask NT Wright Anything is where I sit down regularly with NT Wright, but we're currently playing out some lectures he gave at the Reimagining Mission in the Global South Oxford Conference recently. So you'll be able to hear that on the latest edition of Ask NT Wright Anything. Matters of Life and Death with Tim and John Wyatt is looking at social media and politics, as they're joined by Tim Farron, who of course joined me on this show last week, to talk about politics, the judgmental society, 3,000 offensive tweets a day, freedom from versus freedom to, and of course Elon Musk's Twitter. So lots being discussed by the lads over at Matters of Life and Death. On the C.S. Lewis podcast, Terry Ann Kavanagh is sharing her story of finding faith through C.S. Lewis with Ruth this past week, so that's worth a listen. And Ruth's also speaking to Charles Foster on our Unapologetic podcast about the truth behind the Christmas story. Loads of great content there from our podcasts, and also loads of great articles. I don't mention these enough, but we have so many articles now coming out every single day on our website, premierunbelievable.com. Some of them very seasonal, obviously, as we approach Christmas. Jay Warner Wallace writing for us on 5 reasons we can trust the nativity narratives. Does God answer prayer in a miraculous way? That's being answered by John Clarke. And an article called Joy to the World, and this is Ruth Jackson herself recalling her experience of miscarriage at Christmas and reflecting on experiencing pain, fear and doubt in a season that's usually about celebration and frivolity. That's really worth a read. And just a short article by me on Christ-free Christmas carols. That's reflecting on a show we did a couple of years ago with a musician who had created an album of Christ-free carols and some of my thoughts on that whole idea. So go and check out all of our podcasts and articles at our website, premierunbelievable.com. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch about recent editions of the show. Last week, politics and Christianity was our subject. I was talking to Patrick Miller and Keith Simon from the Truth Over Tribe podcast, and Jeffrey said, "I feel like I have to comment. By and large, I enjoyed hearing them and may even look into the book, but I have to call out one point that I took issue with." They were commenting on how conservatives were opposed to President Clinton because of his moral failures, but then turned around and dismissed President Trump's moral issues. I have to suggest that Patrick and Keith follow their own advice and actually talk to people that supported Trump, myself included. I in no way, shape or form was okay with President Trump's background. In 2016, he was not my first choice or even second or third. But at the end of the day, we were presented with either him or a person whose history of corruption and immorality, in my opinion, frankly, dwarfed Trump's. And that's what we were given to choose from. Yes, I would like to elect a pastor in chief with a solid Christian background, but none were available at that point that could realistically win an election. So I had to go with the lesser of two evils, and millions of conservatives, I bet, felt the same way. Aside from that, I enjoyed the conversation and they made a lot of sense. I just wish we could have had more time to discuss the application of what they were saying and what we do with the information they presented, especially if the other side, meaning both left and right, don't want to talk or discuss. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Jeffrey. Good to hear from you. Curtis Ferrell got in touch via Facebook on a recent classic replay, atheist Alom Shaha and Christian Sharon Dirks discussing suffering. And you say, "Alom Shaha demands a testable hypothesis for God's existence. But testable hypotheses are possible because for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But by definition, God is immaterial and can choose to act or react, removing the possibility of a so-called testable hypothesis. Even if someone claimed to have a testable hypothesis, it could easily be discarded because that hypothesis is based on faulty premises. A testable hypothesis is impossible for proving the existence of an immaterial being who can choose to get involved or not." Thank you very much, Curtis. And just going back to a show we broadcast a little while ago now on Kingdom Mission, Joseph D'Souza and Andrew Scott joined me. Had this interesting email in from Chris in Atoria, New Zealand, who says, "The discussion between Joseph D'Souza and Andrew Scott was fascinating. So much of what they say is clearly right, and they know much more about it than me, in terms of missionary patriarchy, cultural mistakes, Western assumptions, making unnecessary messes and barriers in the global South. As an aside, I remember talking to a Ugandan friend once with great concern about homosexuality laws that were being passed in Uganda, and he showed me how little of the cultural situation I knew when I was judging them. I also loved the way they were able to acknowledge the overall good work done by missionaries in the past, even when I was flawed and could have been better. That ability to recognise the good amidst imperfection from the past seems to me to be something we're increasingly unable to do, and it was refreshing to hear. Yet on two fronts, I was unconvinced, even whilst acknowledging my lack of personal experience in the global South. Firstly, biblically, the focus on the Gospels regarding the kingdom was great, and to acknowledge the breadth of the impact of the kingdom of God was great, as was the image of God emphasis and the desire to bring dignity to those who bear that image but are not being given dignity. And yet at the same time, to deny the priority of evangelism just seems disingenuous to the Gospels and the wider New Testament. I recognise the issues that poorly framed and poorly executed evangelism have raised for D'Souza and many others, but the answer can't be to downplay the biblical importance of evangelism. For instance, Matthew's Gospel finishes with the Great Commission. Not that it isn't just about souls saved, but making disciples. And Luke ends with the call for the message of repentance for the forgiveness of sins to be preached to all nations, which is then played out throughout the book of Acts with constant preaching of the gospel and calling people to follow Jesus. You just can't get around the New Testament emphasis on the need to share the message of Jesus with others intentionally, even as that in no way negates the other emphases that go along with it, which D'Souza emphasised. I know D'Souza said that people will still come to faith, etc., but he didn't, as far as I heard, say anything positive about intentionally sharing the message of Jesus, and yet did say negative things about evangelism. And secondly, you want to say, Chris, the other thing that struck me throughout the conversation is the fact that Global South leaders I am most in contact with are very different. As an Anglican, they are largely African, South American and Southeast Asian. And they constantly talk in terms of evangelism. In fact, much more than we do in the West. They're constantly training evangelists unashamedly and preaching and planting churches. Perhaps they're adopting Western modes here, but they seem to me to be adapting things very much to their own culture. And I dare not presume these intelligent, capable and courageous people are simply unthinkingly copying what missionaries have done in the past. It's very much their own movements and methods, and they're more than capable of working out what works in their own cultural settings. So I guess I would say the Global South view of kingdom work when it comes to things like evangelism and church planting is not quite as monochrome as you might have thought from listening to the show. It would be fascinating to hear Bishop D'Souza discuss his ideas with, say, one of the African bishops in the GAFCON or Global South movements. Far too long an email, but thanks for these stimulating discussions. Well, we got through it, Chris, and thank you for those thoughts. Very helpful. I'm always open to your thoughts, your responses, your robust critiques of shows and the positions of guests. Always welcome. This is the show where we try and bring all kinds of partners to the table to discuss these issues. So thank you very much for being with me on today's show. Just a reminder that we've got that John Lennox course still available till the end of the month at 30% discount if you go to premierunbelievable.com/Lennox. The link is with today's show, of course. And we've also launched our end of year appeal. If you'd like to support Premier Unbelievable in bringing thinking faith to skeptics, seekers and believers, then please do click on the link and help us start 2023 really strong. For now, thanks for being with us. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Well, next time we'll be hearing some of the people that Premier Unbelievable has reached over the past few years. Nico Tarquinio is one of them. He'll be telling us about his journey from being a really dedicated atheist to having this remarkable adult conversion to Christianity. Some really interesting points along the journey as well that he'll describe. So Nico joins me on the show next week to tell his story, alongside another recent convert to Christianity, Martin Shaw. Now, Martin is from a completely different background. He's a mythologist and a storyteller who's had a very interesting journey to Christianity himself in the past year or two. So you'll hear all about that on next week's Christmas special. So wherever you're listening from, thank you for being part of the Unbelievable family. And I do wish you a very happy Christmas, and I hope you can join us for our Christmas special same time next week. For now, thanks for being with us. See you then.